WPFT 90.1. Call 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org. Become somebody who gives, who donates, and it'll make you feel good.
Listen for his music and other local artists here on KPFT.
Hi, this is Pat Byrne. You're listening to Houston's community station, KPFT.
Hey, this is Rodney Crowell, and you're listening to KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio for peace.
Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
Tuned in to the Progressive Forum right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Pacifica Station, Pacifica Radio, right here in Houston, Texas. Welcome to our show this evening. We're going to start off with our regular segment from Jim Hightower. Then we have This Week in History, and that will be followed by my interview with our guest tonight, the author Rochelle Winkle Wagner. And she's going to talk to us about her book, her latest book, The Chosen We, Black Women's Empowerment in Higher Education. After our interview, we will have a bird's eye view, followed by Larry's segment with the news from Larry, and that will take us to the top of the hour. We hope you can stay with us through the whole hour, and let's go ahead and kick things off with Jim Hightower.
The morning after the election, a social media pundit expressed amazement that Democrat Kamala Harris had lost, noting that America is enjoying an objectively strong economy. Indeed, the data show impressive job growth, rising wages, slowing inflation, etc., all indicators of a solid economy. Nearly every pundit hailed this as meaning Harris's campaign could glide on rising prosperity, while focusing her main message on what a dangerous, bumbling buffoon Trump is. The problem is that objective economic data often deceives. For example, consider economist John Kenneth Galbraith's sad tale of the 6-foot-tall statistician who drowned crossing a stream with an average depth of 2 feet. Millions of Americans are drowning in today's economy. Even workaday people with college degrees are struggling to make ends meet and feeling pessimistic about their future. Happy talk by economists, pundits, and politicians doesn't pay the rising bills for rent, childcare, groceries, insurance, medicines, etc. Everything is moving out of reach, except a protest vote. About half of Trump voters say high prices were, quote, the largest factor in their vote. Democratic Party officials were dazzled by the soaring Dow Jones average, ignoring the Doug Jones average, which showed that Doug and Donna are struggling, anxious, angry, and even open to a bull goose demagogue blustering that he'll fix the rigged system on day one. This is Jim Hightower saying, few of these hard-hit men and women actually believe in, agree with, trust, or even like Trump, nor are they stuck on supporting him. But they will be unless and until some progressive party decides to side with grassroots people in an unabashed fight for economic fairness and social justice. To help push in that direction, go to workingfamilies.org.
Okay, and now we have This Week in History. In 1933, this is the week of November 13th to November 18th, 1933, workers win sit-down strike at Hormel in Austin, Minnesota. In 1974, whistleblower Karen Silkwood dies on her way to meeting with reporters. In 1960, a white mob riots as Ruby Bridges, at the age of six, starts her first day of first grade at previously all-white William France Elementary School in New Orleans, Louisiana. In 1969, hundreds of thousands march for the war moratorium in Washington, D.C. And in 1980, saw the Women's March on the Pentagon, the Women's Pentagon Action March. And in 1937, 1,000 students and faculty at UNC Chapel Hill host the Imperial Wizard of the KKK. And in 1872, Susan B. Anthony was arrested for voting. And that was This Week in History. My guest tonight is Rochelle Winkle Wagner. She is the author of the book, The Chosen We. In her book, The Chosen We elevates the oral histories of 105 accomplished, college-educated black women who earned success despite experiencing reprehensible racist and sexist barriers. The central argument is that these women succeeded in and beyond college by developing a chosen we, that is, a community with one another. And the book builds on their words and insights to offer a powerful rethinking of educational success that moves away from individualistic and competitive models and instead imagines success as a result of recognizing what people owe to one another. Our guest, the author, Rochelle Winkle Wagner, is professor of educational leadership and policy analysis at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She's the co-author with Angela M. Locks of Diversity and Inclusion on Campus, Supporting Students of Color in Higher Education, and the author of The Unchosen Me, Race, Gender, and Identity Among Black Women in College, among other books. Welcome to the Progressive Forum, Rochelle.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. First of all, this was a fascinating book. As mentioned in the intro, you looked at 105 black women and highlight their stories. And what my main takeaway was, the history of the so many barriers of that face these women in their journey to getting an education. And I'd like to start, as a way of introduction, with the story of, in your opening, of Rita May and from the South and what she had to overcome herself. I mean, this was in the South, in a time of segregation, and what she herself endured and overcame to become a student in. And you refer to these as predominantly white institutions, and how these black women created space or made space for themselves as they attended these institutions. Can you talk about Rita May, Rochelle?
Yes, absolutely. So Rita May was a black woman who attended a predominantly white institution in the South, as you said, and she, like many women in the book, were often in a position of facing the history in our country of racial segregation in public schooling. So higher education really followed the same pattern as did K-12 education, where many people were going to school with people who were like them, and that was legal at the time, where, you know, black students were particularly disallowed from going to school with white students. So Rita May was growing up in that era where she was trying to go to school, trying to go to college at a time when she would have attended mostly black K-12 schools, and coming out of that racial segregation.
She was in the 1950s. I'm sorry, right, Rochelle? Is that when?
Right,
she,
yeah. Correct. Yes.
So this was a time of segregation.
This was a time. Yeah, she was growing up in segregation, and so these were times when, you know, some of the women in the book were going to school you completely segregated mm-hmm. with, you know, only black students, and they would go to college as colleges and universities were starting to open their doors to black students that had not previously been allowed to go to these institutions, like our major state institutions, you know, University of Texas, for example. They, as students were entering these institutions, they would have been coming onto campus as one of just a handful of black women at that time. You know, they may have looked around the campus and quite literally only seen, you know, a few other people who looked like them mm-hmm. on that campus. Because in the 1950s, most black women would have attended what we call historically black colleges or universities. So these would be universities like Prairie View A&M right. or Texas Southern in the state of Texas,
right,
for example.
Right here in Houston. It's just down the road from
yeah,
us.
Yeah, right there in Houston, exactly. And so, you know, most black women would have would not have gone to predominantly white institutions at that time. Right. But some did. And if they did, like Rita Mae, they would have walked onto college campuses and not been around a lot of other black mm-hmm. students. And so I had, you know, women in the book who were going to campuses at this time in the 1950s and in the 1960s who quite literally talked about, you know, having to find other black students as a form of survival in these campuses, because just like in K-12 schools at that time, as schools did start to integrate in the late 1950s and 1960s, the spaces were not all that welcoming to black students, to black women. And so, you know, they were not only trying to go to institutions that were not necessarily going to be welcoming to them, but also would have to find and make space for themselves in those institutions that honestly didn't have a lot of spaces already created for them.
I'm trying to imagine what kind of courage that must have taken at that time to be, and we talk not to a minority, but a tiny minority in these cases, right?
Right, yes. Yeah, it really, you know, would have taken enormous courage that most of us can't even imagine. I, you know, listening to the history that was coming on before we started to talk, you know, Ruby Bridges was
yes.
trying to integrate a public school.
That was in 1960. School.
Right. And having rocks thrown at her, you know, having racial epithets hurled at her.
Right.
And she was just a child. And, you know, you think about these young women going onto college campuses at this time, and it takes a profound amount of courage to enter these institutions, all in an effort to just get the same education that white students had been getting for quite some time.
Right. And as you mentioned in the book, so the book is basically how these black women created community, how they found each other, and I thought that was so comforting in a way. So to carry on, so they were left out of mainstream social spaces, right? And even the mainstream
absolutely.
Conversation.
Yes, absolutely. So, Rita Mae, as an example, went to University of New Haven up in Connecticut. So she, you know, traveled from New Orleans up to the north to attend what I would refer to in the book as a predominantly white institution,
yeah.
which is really just an institution that has 50% or more white students and probably had a history of racial segregation
sure.
and exclusion where black students wouldn't have been allowed to go at one point. And so she traveled up. She not only left, you know, her homeland, you know, her in Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
but she traveled up to the north to attend this institution. And then as people entered these institutions, particularly in the 1950s and 1960s, there would have often been there would not have been roommates for them, you know, like in her case, you know, there would not have been somebody to stay with in the dorms who
right.
looked like them. So they might have had a white roommate who maybe had never been around black people before,
right.
You know, and there would be people would talk about, you know, going to class and, you know, seeing maybe one other black student all day in class. I had another woman who went to the University of Iowa in the 1960s, and she talked about, you know, she had a residence hall with 400 students in the residence hall, and there were only three black women in the wow. entire residence hall. And so she said, you know, we had to find each other. It was yeah. it was really a matter of survival. And, you know, they became really close friends and developed what I refer to in the book as a chosen we
yes.
community, a space where they felt like they could just belong and be themselves. And in the case of the person who went to the University of Iowa, she goes by Janelle in the
mm-hmm.
book.
Yeah, I read her
She maintained
story.
Those relationships throughout her life. You
right.
know, I interviewed her in her 70s. And she was still friends with the people that she met that first year in college.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and to think, I mean, in Rita May's case, I can't remember Janelle, she traveled far from home. She's come from New Orleans. I mean, that's about as far north as you can get from New Orleans to Connecticut. So there's no
yes.
family, there's no support system. She is on her own.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
What did do universities have resources? I'm thinking not for these young women.
At that time, no. You know, most universities, this would have been before before the time of what we would now refer to as black student unions,
yeah,
black student governments.
Yeah.
There were black sororities on some campuses, and those became support
right.
of support that
but not
I
everywhere.
Would call chosen we in the book, but not everywhere.
Right.
And many campuses were late to that game, and certainly, like in the 1950s, they wouldn't have
sure.
They wouldn't have had those spaces. And so what we see throughout the book is that black women are going on to these campuses in some cases, like Rita May,
mm-hmm.
Where black women have not really gone before. You know, they're one of the few and one of the first
mm-hmm.
to arrive on these campuses. There are no support systems. There are no support offices or programs that are meant to support black students at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And these, you know, many of these black women, they take this situation and they build and they maintain and they create something that formerly did not exist, and that is spaces for black women to belong, and not only belong, but thrive, you know,
mm-hmm.
spaces where they can come together and support each other, not just in college, but often for the long haul of their career and their lives. And then, you know, these black women go on, and every single one of them in the book that I interviewed, you know, these are leaders of their communities, they're leaders in their disciplines, their fields, that, you know, that they go into for their careers. And ultimately, they build themselves a legacy that didn't
right.
exist before.
So interesting. I'd like to, this book arose out of your earlier book, The Unchosen Me. The Unchosen Me, Race, Gender, and Identity Among Black Women in College. And you yourself, Rochelle, are white. How did this subject connect with you? What made you write The Unchosen Me, your earlier book, which gave rise to this book, The Chosen We?
Yes. So The Unchosen Me was a book that I wrote earlier in my career that was an ethnography of black women who were currently enrolled at the time at a predominantly white big research university in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a year following these undergraduate black women who were just in college at the time.
Right.
They were relatively young, so ages 18 to 22. And I followed them for a year and tried to understand, you know, what's it like to be a black woman on a college campus that is predominantly white
right.
In contemporary times. And that book ends up being a bit of a sad story because the black women in that book, while they did finish college and while they did, you know, get through the experience, in many ways they felt as if their identity, who they could be on campus, was imposed on them. So
mm-hmm.
I ended up calling the book The Unchosen Me because the black women in the book kept talking about moments where they felt as if who the me was, who they were supposed to be, was not something that they really got to choose. So, for example, they felt like they had to act a particular way around white students and white professors and white peers on campus.
Right.
And then they'd have to act a totally different way around their black peers. And right. they never just got to figure out who they were. So they had to, you know, pretend to have a certain musical preference or a certain, you know, book preference or a certain, you know, way of thinking and acting. And after the book was published, I am a white woman, and, you know, I had worked with the woman in that book for a really long time. After the book was published, some of the reviews came out on the book, and I agreed with these reviews, and that is that there wasn't a lot of agency in the book, meaning that it didn't seem like black women in the book who were young got to necessarily assert themselves and resist all these pressures coming at them about who they're supposed to be. And I was curious about that. And this came up in reviews as you know, an issue with the book. And I felt like that, too. I felt like, well, gosh, there must be more resistance there than I saw. You know, maybe I just didn't see it. So I went back to the data. I reanalyzed it. I even went back to some of the participants, talked to them. And what I finally realized in conversation with a mentor of mine who ends up writing the foreword for my book, The Chosen We, Diana Slaughter Coatesman, and she's a black woman who was an academic for 40 years and is retired now. And she said to me during one of our conversations, she said, you know, Rochelle, I think the reason that maybe we're not seeing as much agency and resistance in this earlier study is that they were young and they hadn't had a chance to really reflect back and think about how that experience shaped them and what they did and how they maybe really did resist. And so I set out, based on this conversation with Diana Slaughter Coatesman, I ended up saying, okay, I'm gonna talk to people who already graduated, so college alums, and I want them to have had a good long time. In some cases, you know, the women I talked to were, you know, upwards of 50, 60, 70 years old. I wanted them to have had a good long time to really reflect on what happened in college, what did it mean to their lives, and how did they perhaps resist some of these pressures that were coming at who they're supposed to be. And what I end up finding in the Chosen We is that they resisted in community with one another. They, you know, black women have long understood, and I think did understand even in that earlier book, they just hadn't had a chance to reflect on it yet. But I think they've always understood black women, something that many groups don't understand, and that is that their liberation is tied to one another, and that in community with one another, there can be resistance and there can be a new way of being on a college campus or in any space in society.
Certainly. And I think that your book, The Chosen We, really brings that out. I mean, you definitely get, or at least I got a very strong, clear sense of these women's agency in charting in how they create space, how they make the space that they're in, make it their own, how they make it create these connections so that they can navigate the space in these predominantly white institutions, because it is so different. It's such a different experience for them, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I'm very comforted and excited, actually, that it turned out that way in this book, you know, that really across time and space, you know, this is a 60-year time period, the oral histories in this book represent a 60-year time period of college graduation dates, and across time and space, you know, there were five metropolitan cities that I included in the book. I just got this resounding answer over and over again, you know, how in a society that has often been set up in a way that is not positioned for black women to succeed, and sometimes there's actually visible barriers put in place for black women, how in this society and within institutions like higher education have black women been able to thrive and succeed? And that was really the question I was after in the book, and I just kept getting the same answer, and it plays out in different ways. But, you know, the answer is that black women have succeeded and thrived by building community with one another.
Wow, And let's. I would like to go and talk about the story of Patrice Kenyatta from California. That was another interesting story that you bring out. She comes from actually a privileged family, and both her parents were activists, right?
Correct.
And she faces different kinds of pressure as well, because she, in a way, doesn't want to follow. Is that a way? Maybe that's simplifying it. But she, both her parents were very accomplished and very active in the Black Liberation Movement, I guess, but from an academic way. And can you talk about Patrice? Her story is very fascinating.
Yeah, her story is fascinating. You know, one thing that I really loved about Patrice's oral history is that there was this moment at the beginning of her interview that I think is important to share.
Yeah.
Given that I'm a white woman and I've dedicated my life and career to working with and elevating Black women's lives, and that is that when I sat down with Patrice, she knew that I was a white woman and we were going to have this conversation, and the person who had introduced us, you know, told her that I was a white woman. And when I sat down with her, she said to me, she said, you know, I interviewed her in Atlanta, which is where she was living at the time. She said, you know, Rochelle, why should I talk to you? Why should I tell you my story? Mm-hmm. And it was this great moment because I said to her the thing that I said to many people when we first started our conversations, and that is, you know, I said, I don't know if you should. I think the way I view this conversation and the way I view this work is that every minute that we're together is a chance for me to either build trust and get the honor of learning about your life, or to betray that trust. And mm-hmm. to be honest, white women don't have a great history in this country of supporting
nope.
Black women.
Nope.
And so that history entered the room before we even had a chance to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told her all this, and I said, you know, let's just talk for a while, and then you can decide if this is the right choice to tell me your story. So Patrice actually interviewed me for a good 45 minutes or an hour before we rolled tape, and, you know, before I interviewed her,
mm-hmm.
And really talked to me about, you know, why are you doing this work? What's this work mean to you? What have you done in the past? So we had a really lovely conversation where I was able to become more vulnerable to her and share with her, you know, my own work and my own thinking. And then eventually she said, okay, all right, let's do this. I'm going to tell you my story now. And so we did. So we really had this kind of beautiful sharing
yeah.
across. And I think that's an important moment because I really think, you know, my goal with the book and with the work that I do is to build bridges across
yeah.
racial lines. And it's always a goal, and it doesn't mean that I'm always able to accomplish it, but every moment, you know, is a chance to try again.
Absolutely.
And to try that goal.
So
so Patrice, you know, her story starts that way,
yeah.
and then she ends up, you know, offering up this just really vivid and compelling story of, you know, what it's like to be a Black woman coming from a relatively activist and in some ways affluent background, and what it's like to try to, you know, go to these different college campuses that she ends up going to and to try to fit in. And, you know, she goes to a small women's college in California,
mm-hmm.
Doesn't particularly feel like she fits in there, in part because she often is feeling like she's not Black enough, quote unquote, meaning that she's
because
not
of her parents. You think, Rochelle, because they were so active in the civil rights movement?
I suspect so.
Yeah.
She also was a light-skinned Black woman. You know,
okay.
There were some colorism
mm-hmm.
Things that I think she was also facing. She was relatively affluent, you know, in her background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she continues forward in her education. She, you know, goes to UCLA. Her brother is, you know, part of the Black Panther,
mm-hmm.
Black Nationalist movement, and actually has some death threats for a while and has to go into hiding. You know, she really She really is a, she lived out the civil rights movement in many ways in her life. And while she goes from, you know, campus to campus and is trying so hard to find spaces, she finally finds in her life that the best space and the most authentic space for her to thrive really is with other Black women. In her case, she starts to learn how to do that in college and then carries that forward into her later life. And you know, by the time I talked to her, she was building out a legacy of a Pan-African women's group. Mm-hmm. So she was trying to really elevate Black women in this really, you know, global sort of way. So she actually ends up carrying forward some of her experiences, negative and positive, and ends up persisting with building community with Black women later in her life.
Right. So in her story, I came across these groups that I was not familiar with, the Lynx and Jack and Jill, and these were, this is another wonderful example of how Black communities create space where they can then connect with they're carving out their own space because some of these clubs, if you will, are available to them, so they make their own.
Exactly. So the Lynx and Jack and Jill are relatively storied Black organizations that are primarily, you know, relatively affluent organizations for really, you know, Black community members and leaders. You know, Jack and Jill, for example, often gives young children opportunities to be around other Black children.
Is this like
and Black families?
Scouts, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts? Is it kind of?
Yeah,
like
it's
that?
Similar. The thing I think that differentiates it is it's a way for, in a society where, you know, there aren't, I mean, outside of some cities, you know, Atlanta, for example, has more representation in Black leadership in the city. But there are some spaces where, you know, Black children could grow up and not see all the Black leadership around them,
right.
You know, people who are doctors and lawyers and judges and, you know, leaders of their communities, mayors, et cetera. And so Jack and Jill, one of the things that Jack and Jill does well, I think, is often offers children an opportunity to see all this representation around them mm-hmm. of what, you know, some people in my book refer to as Black greatness. You know, where they can see leadership and representation and begin to envision their lives in a different way that has them as leaders and them as, you know, people that are, you know, the top of their field. So, you know, Jack and Jill provides that. And Lynx is similar. You know, these are also social organizations that, you know, community service and they provide social opportunities. Patrice grew up in those organizations and later opted to not be a part of those organizations, but did continue forward with other sorts of Black community organizations that mm-hmm. That she felt to be more inclusive of various socioeconomic backgrounds, so high income, low income, etc., and that felt important to her.
So can you talk to us about how was the housing at these, these halls, residence halls, how were they arranged at these predominantly white institutions? What sort of housing arrangements were these young Black women facing when they would come on campus?
It depends on the decade. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as we...
say in Rita May's instance, was that where she's in Connecticut?
Yeah. So in Rita May's instance in the 1950s, it's very likely that most Black women who would have been going to predominantly white institutions would have been most likely rooming with a white student. And it may be the case that the white student that they're rooming with had never been friends with or even really been in community at all with, mm-hmm. With a Black student. And so it's setting that relationship up in some time. In some instances, they, you know, people do become friends, but in some instances, it sets it up to be very racially oppressive and marginalizing for the Black woman, because then she can't even go to her dorm room and feel, you know, safe and comfortable in some cases. You know, as time wears on, as we get into the 1990s, for example, and early 2000s, the alum that I talked to that graduated a little bit later on in the 1990s and 2000s, they tended to have, because there just were, you know, more possibilities of rooming with Black students, they could, in some instances, make some choices about their roommate and, you know, whether they wanted to room with somebody who looked like them, you know, another black woman, or if they wanted to, you know, room with somebody, you know, anybody from any racial or ethnic background. And so there were a little bit more, there was more opportunity for people to choose. Also, as we get into the 1990s and 2000s, some universities started to have multicultural floors or African-American or Black community floors, and so some students could choose, if they wanted to live on those floors in the residence halls, and it would be voluntary. You know, they could choose to do that, they could choose not to do that,
right?
But there would have been different housing options, and there were as students entered into the, you know, 1980s, 90s, 2000s.
So, and another thing I got out of your book was the rise of these black sororities. I mean, they existed early on, but there seems to be a lot more now, right?
There are there's a heavier presence, I would say, of
maybe that's
black
a better way of putting it. Yeah,
yeah, on some campuses now than there used to be. So, you know, a lot of the historically Black colleges and universities did have the Black sororities on those campuses, but many of those chapters of the sororities didn't translate or go up to the predominantly white institution campuses, you know, particularly in the North, for a little while. And so while the historically Black colleges and universities, you know, the sororities would have been on those campuses for decades and decades, it just took a while for some of those chapters to get a chapter going on the predominantly white institution campuses. And then it did become, in many instances, a much bigger opportunity and a much bigger impact on the campus in terms of really giving a visible face to, okay, there's a group of Black women on campus and they're in this sorority and they're doing all this, you know, community work on campus and in the community. So it just becomes more visible, I think, over time as these sororities start to open chapters on different campuses.
Well, this has been fascinating, Rochelle. I think that takes us to about the end of our time. May I close our discussion with a quote that you include in the book from Audre Lorde, which I thought kind of was wonderful.
Yes, indeed.
We are African women, and we know in our blood's telling the tenderness with which our foremothers held each other. It is that connection which we're seeking. We have stories of Black women who healed each other's wounds, raised each other's children, fought each other's battles, tilled each other's earth, and eased each other's passages into life and into death. We know the possibilities of support and connection for which we all yearn and about which we dream so often. And that is by Audre Lorde. And you include this in your book, which I thought kind of summarized the subject of your book.
She just says it the best. Audre Lorde always says it the best.
Yeah. Powerful stuff. Rochelle, thank you so much for joining us here tonight on the Progressive Forum. I really appreciate that. And good luck in your work.
Thank you so much.
And let me just remind our listeners, I've been speaking with Rochelle Winkle-Wagner. She's the author of the book, The Chosen We, Black Women's Empowerment in Higher Education. Thanks again, Rochelle.
Thank you. I know that you.
evening. This is Lillian Kerr with a bird's eye view, a woman's perspective. Tonight we're going to look at a brief biography of Ruby Hurley, a civil rights pioneer and campaigner. Ruby Hurley was born in 1909 and she passed away in 1980. And this comes from the website of womenshistory.org. Civil rights pioneer and campaigner Ruby Hurley is most known for her work with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, in the 1950s and 1960s. She was an advocate for nonviolent legislative activities which advocated equality for all. Ruby Hurley was born and raised in Washington, D.C. Her parents were Alice and Edward Ruffin. However, not much is known about them. They were not in Hurley's life by 1920, when she was known to be living with teachers Emma and Perry Ray. Hurley attended the academically oriented and predominantly African-American school, Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C. The school attracted many well-educated instructors, among them the son of Frederick Douglass, who taught Hurley. She graduated from high school in 1926. She then went on to attend Minor Teachers College in D.C. Opened in 1851 as the Colored Girls' School by Myrtilla Minor, the institution was dedicated to training teachers, particularly African-American educators. After completing college, Hurley worked for a short time in the federal government, and then she was employed by the Industrial Bank of Washington, an African-American-owned financial institution. While working, she also attended evening law courses at the Robert H. Terrell Law School. The school, which was based in D.C., focused on providing law degrees to African Americans. Although Hurley did not complete a degree with the school, she gained knowledge about the legislative process, which invariably helped her in her career with the NAACP. Hurley's activities with the NAACP began in 1939. In that year, Marian Anderson, the world-famous opera singer, had been hired by the Daughters of the American Revolution to give a performance at the organization's Constitution Hall. However, the DAR cancelled the concert because Anderson was African-American. Eleanor Roosevelt, a member of the DAR and First Lady, resigned in protest against the organization's racial discrimination. Hurley swung into action. She and a committee of NAACP civil rights advocates moved the performance to the Lincoln Memorial. Anderson's concert was held on April 9, 1939, and it was attended by thousands in D.C. From this time onwards, Hurley was an active member of the NAACP in Washington, D.C. In recognition of her work for the organization, she was made its National Youth Secretary in 1943 and continued in this position until 1952. During this time, she greatly enhanced the organization's membership. In 1951, the NAACP sent Hurley to Birmingham, Alabama, for 3 months to expand its membership in five southern states: Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, and Tennessee. Hurley's work would later expand to recruiting new members in North and South Carolina. She was also tasked with strengthening ties between local NAAC branches and the main branch of the NAACP located in New York City. The next year, the NAACP decided to establish the Southeast Regional Branch of the NAACP, and Hurley was first named Regional Secretary and then Director of this new group. Through the 50s and 60s, under Hurley's guidance and oversight, this branch would become the largest group within the NAACP, reaching over 90,000 members by the end of the 1960s. Her main activities as director of the Southeast Regional Branch included civil rights advocacy, increasing NAACP membership, representing NAACP at numerous events, and investigating racial incidents and murders in this area of the country. She investigated and compiled reports, which she gave to the FBI and the NAACP on the murders of Reverend George Lee, who was killed in Belzoni, Mississippi in 1955, and Medgar Evers' assassination in Brookhaven, Mississippi in 1963. Hurley also examined the murder of Emmett Till in Moni, Mississippi, in 1955. She went undercover, dressed as a cotton picker, in order to travel to different plantations and interview eyewitnesses about Till's death. Hurley's civil rights activities did not go unnoticed by local authorities and people living in the area. She was often threatened by individuals driving by her home and received obscene phone calls and death threats at her home. Bombs were thrown at her house. She lost a great deal of weight and did not have much of an appetite and refused to eat in segregated restaurants and bus stops. However, she was often on the road recruiting new members and had little to eat. She carried chocolate bars with her, but if she ran out of the bars, she would go without food. Her travel schedule often meant she would go without food for a 24-hour period. She was ill many times, and her doctor diagnosed her with having situational stress disorder. In June 1956, Alabama passed an injunction on AACP's activities, and the organization was banned from raising funds and recruiting new members. The state also sought to obtain Southeast Regional's membership list, which would have been catastrophic for its members. Hurley closed the branch that day and relocated to Atlanta, Georgia. After 39 years of service and dedication to the NAACP, Hurley retired from the organization on March 31, 1978. In her career, Hurley was one of the few women to rise to prominence within the organization. Ruth Hurley died on August 9, 1980, leaving behind a legacy of civil rights advocacy. Her accomplishments were recognized by the United States Post Office in 2009 with the release of a commemorative stamp in the Civil Rights Pioneers Stamp Series. That was a biography of Ruby Hurley, and this has been Lillian Kerr with a Bird's Eye View.
This is the news on the Progressive Forum. More than 1.7 million families in the United Kingdom plan to turn off their heaters this winter. This is an increase of 75% compared to 2023. The study by YouSwitch indicates that 55% of British households mentioned increased living expenses as the reason they would avoid heating their homes. 25% of elderly British seniors cited the loss of winter fuel subsidies for not heating their homes, this even though it might pose a health risk for the older people. As the British prepare for winter nights at home, orders for hot water bottles have surged by 2.5 times, and demand for heated blankets has risen by over 2 times the period in 2023. One personal heating solution is for Britishers to use heated clothing, which may be a huge heating cost saver. It is noteworthy that despite these hardships faced by the British people, the United Kingdom governments continue to fund foreign wars in the name of so-called democracy. A British children's charity published a report detailing how families living in poverty in the United Kingdom are forced to sleep on the floor since they cannot afford beds. The study surveyed 1,567 families, which was conducted by Butyl UK, an organization supporting children and young people in crisis. The study found that most families struggled to find money to heat and power their homes. The survey revealed that most families had also skipped meals for their children. Black mold endemic in homes was another issue many families faced in Britain, making it difficult to remove due to cold and damp conditions forced upon them by the lack of being able to afford heating. This story is of Western and U.S. governments who continue to support oligarch capitalism and war, always at the expense of their citizens. Last Sunday, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel oversaw recovery efforts following the damage caused by Hurricane Rafael. The Cuban president also assessed the impact of earthquake activity in the eastern region of Cuba. An impactful 6.8 Richter scale earthquake struck Cuba on Sunday amid a difficult recovery from recent power failures and damaging hurricane activity. The Cuban National Defense Council has maintained constant communication with party leaders in the provinces of Santiago de Cuba and Granma, which were severely affected by earthquake tremors. Cuban government and authorities prioritize attention to housing, electrical infrastructure, and landslides caused by the earthquakes. Residents of high-rise buildings are being kept safe. Health experts, communicators, and psychologists were also mobilized to the most affected areas of Cuba. The Cuban National Defense Council meeting discussed measures to ensure the supply of water, food, and maintenance of smooth communication with Cuban provincial defense councils. On Monday, news was reported that Iran and Russia have linked their national payment systems. This is a significant move to bypass the U.S. dollar SWIFT banking system in bilateral financial transactions. The linkage between Russia's Mir and Iran's Shetab payment systems was established in a ceremony attended by Governor of the Central Bank of Iran and the Iranian ambassador to Moscow. The ceremony unveiled the first phase of the project, which enables Iranian citizens to use their bank cards to withdraw cash in rubles from Russian ATMs. In the second phase, Russian nationals will be able to withdraw cash in Iran. The final phase will allow Iranians to make purchases at Russian stores using point-of-sale devices with their bank cards. Central Bank of Iran Governor Mohammad Reza Farsin said the integration of the two countries' banking subsystems is a big step towards creating integrated economic cooperation in the region. This, completing the de-dollarization process and facilitating economic and tourism relations between Iran and the Russian Federation. Since the 2018 reimposition of U.S. sanctions on Iran and Western sanctions on Russia more than 10 years ago, Moscow and Tehran have been working together to strengthen their banking systems. U.S. and European illegal sanctions have blocked access to key parts of the global financial infrastructure. This reality prompted Iran and Russia to work towards creating a rival to the SWIFT payments messaging service that underpins cross-border payments across the global economies. While the immediate consequence of this move is facilitation of economic relations, the most important result is de-dollarization. De-dollarization is a spreading global economic trend where countries are gradually reducing their reliance on the U.S. dollar for international commerce. The move by Russia and Iran is watershed in complete removal of the dollar from their global exchanges as a reference currency. De-dollarization will gradually deprive the United States of using sanctions as a weapon against other countries. From November 19th through November 21st, the African nation of Niger will host the Conference in Solidarity with the Peoples of the Sahel. The three-day international event is dedicated to addressing the urgent struggles and aspirations of the Sahelian people. The African Sahel is a vast region spanning parts of Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. The region has long been marked by economic hardship and security crises. In recent years, new governments of these nations have taken strong steps towards breaking free from foreign influence and asserting local sovereignty. While facing long-standing instability, these nations have made it clear they wish to set their own path, a path that is not shaped by external forces, but by the needs and desire of their people. The Conference in Solidarity with the Peoples of the Sahel will bring together activists, political leaders, union representatives, and members of social movements and Pan-African communities from around the globe. The event bears the theme, for anti-imperialist unity, peace, and friendship between peoples. This conference marks a critical effort to address conflicts and tensions in the Sahel and to highlight the region's determination to overcome challenges to peace, sovereignty, and dignity. The Sahel's recent political shifts have ignited a movement against foreign military involvement, particularly French influence. Many local Sahel voices say this has fueled conflict and stymied economic progress of the region. This groundswell of anti-imperialist sentiment has resulted in what organizers describe as patriotic uprisings. These are led by popular forces and progressive alliances within state institutions like the military. These democratic uprisings have reshaped governance in the region as people demand sovereignty and work to assert a more independent future. As the Sahel Confederation moves to reclaim its sovereignty, the impact of its journey will resonate far beyond its borders. The stability and autonomy of the Sahel region influences the security, economy, and migratory patterns across Africa and even Europe. International audiences have observed these changes closely, and activists and policymakers alike are increasingly vocal about what is at stake for the region. And in our final story, a mega drought has been stressing the water supply throughout the southwest United States. Possibly revolutionary research out of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, will address the problem with the groundbreaking technology. The technology has been utilized to extract large amounts of water from the air in very low humidity conditions. The research paper is titled High Yield Atmospheric Water Capture via Bio-Inspired Material Segregation. It was published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This technology and approach has been tested outdoors in Las Vegas and is effective down to 10% ambient humidity. It directly captures water in a liquid salt solution that is suitable for subsequent processing into drinking water or energy production, enabling new capabilities for arid regions of the planet. A key ingredient in the process is a hydrogel membrane. The inspiration for this material comes from living nature. Tree frogs and air plants use a similar technique to transport water from ambient air into a liquid for internal storage. The research demonstrates that atmospheric water harvesting can be solar powered to reduce the theoretical and eventual cost for generating pure water. Research leader, mechanical engineer Professor H. Jeremy Cho, says that planetary water resources are being depleted and our planet's climate is changing. Dr. Cho says that this research represents a significant shift in atmospheric water harvesting, opening doors to continuous operation and new applications of water production. And that's been some of the news on the Progressive Forum.
Well, that brings us to the end of our hour here on the Progressive Forum on Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 FM. Thank you to my co-hosts, Wally James and Larry Krizan, and thank you to Basil on the boards tonight. Please stick around. We have People of Earth coming up next. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.